Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events here in Central Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart, one of your hosts this hour. Normally, we start each Friday's broadcast with a look back at news from the pages of the week's Ames Tribune, but today we begin with the story that made news not just here in Iowa, but across the nation this week, the discovery of Molly Tibbett's body. The 20-year-old University of Iowa student had gone missing July 18th. She had last been seen jogging in the community of Brooklyn. A 24-year-old immigrant from Mexico led authorities to Tibbett's body in a cornfield several miles southeast of Brooklyn. And that man, Christian Bahena Rivera, was charged with first-degree murder and held on a $5 million bond. Authorities said Bahena was an undocumented immigrant. His attorney said that was not the case. Yesterday, autopsy results were announced, revealing that Molly Tibbett died from multiple sharp force injuries. A funeral service for Molly Tibbett will take place on Sunday, this Sunday, in Brooklyn. Now let's take a look back at what made news in the Trib this week here in Ames. Last Saturday, the Trib reported that the Ames School District and Ames High have both received top rankings in the state from a report issued by a company that uses data and reviews to create school rankings. The Ames School District was rated tops, number one on the list for best public schools and districts in the state of Iowa. That's the sixth straight year the Ames District has been ranked tops in the state. In addition, Ames High also received the top ranking among high schools for the fourth year in a row. Ames Middle School and the five elementary schools also ranked very high in the ratings. Those rankings are based on such things as academic strength, quality of teachers, and school resources. State test scores show 89% of all the district students are proficient in math, 88% in reading. Saturday's Trib also reported that a company known as Smart Ag, which was a startup in the Iowa State University Research Park, plans to move into a new office and development space later this fall. The city of Ames and the state have offered loans to the business, which produces aftermarket kits and software to dealers and farmers that let tractors be driven without a human operator. And Saturday's Trib had a front-page story that was reprinted from The Washington Post. It was a look at how one woman and her daughter are making their way here in Ames, which is the metro area that has the nation's lowest jobless rate. The story's overview is that some families here in Ames are feeling economic strain, even though the jobless rate here is only 1.5%. Sunday's Trib reported on a Story County woman who is spreading awareness about diseases carried by ticks. 69-year-old Betty Gordon's husband died 4 years ago, and only afterward did she discover that he had Lyme bacteria in his brain and may have had it for decades. So Betty Gordon had herself tested and discovered she also had Lyme disease. Now she's on a public mission to inform everyone that tick-borne diseases are serious and life-threatening if they're not treated. Sunday's Trib also had word that one of the oldest businesses in Ames would be celebrating its 110th anniversary this past Tuesday. And the staff of Stevens Memorial Chapel was going to be joined by the Ames Historical Society to highlight the history of funeral services. Sunday's Trib also reported that two women with Story County ties have been inducted into the Iowa Women's Hall of Fame. One of them is Diane Bystrom, who served as the director of Iowa State University's Cary Chapman Katz Center for Women in Politics for more than 20 years. The other is Ruth Harkin. She was the first female Story County attorney and went on to become the first woman to serve as deputy counsel at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And Sunday's Trib also had word that major construction in the Roland Story School District is almost finished, just in time for the first day of school, which is next Monday, August 27th. Last year, voters approved a $9 million bond issue to make improvements in all three Roland Story school buildings, and among those projects, added classrooms at the elementary school, as well as remodeling of several spaces, such as the library, the main office, the principal's office, and the nurse's office. The main entrance has also been moved. In addition, high school science classrooms have been renovated. The parking lot at the high school has been resurfaced, and the roof on the south gym has been replaced. Security cameras at all three Roland Story school buildings have been added. Now, an open house is going to be held at the elementary school tomorrow, Saturday, from 9 to 11 a.m., so everyone can see what this new look actually looks like. The Trib is not published on Mondays. Tuesday's edition had word that new research conducted by Iowa State University professors found gender stereotypes and biases are still influencing voters, especially in elections with more than one woman on the ballot. One finding was that if only one woman is a candidate on a ballot, she does just as well or better than men in the same election. But another finding showed that if a female candidate is accompanied by other higher-level office women on the ballot, the so-called down-ballot candidates' chances are negatively affected. Let's simplify this. When two women run on the same ballot, but one is running for a higher-level office, voters tend to only learn about the higher-level candidate. Tuesday's Tribune also reported that work on the second phase of the 13th Street project west of Grand Avenue Ames was set to begin this week. That project began back in June when 13th was blocked from near Ridgewood to Curtis Avenue so crews could install a new water main as well as updated storm and sanitary sewer systems. That part of 13th should reopen by the end of the month, but now work crews are tearing up 13th from Curtis to Harding Avenues, and that means drivers will still need to detour off 13th if they want to get from one side of town to the other. And Tuesday's Trib also had word that teachers from each of the Ames School District's buildings received awards for their efforts in the classroom during the annual Dan Wooden Excellence in Education Award ceremonies on Monday. That award is named after a very popular school board president who died 5 years ago. The overall award was won by Fellows Elementary Principal Brandon Shrouth. Wednesday's Tribune reported that federal disaster aid has been approved for Story County and 29 other counties after several months of severe weather conditions. President Trump signed a proclamation declaring a major disaster in counties in north and central Iowa that suffered tornadoes, flooding, and more back in June and July. Wednesday's Trib also reported that the Ames City Council has removed some positions on the city's Human Relations Commission. Iowa code requires cities with more than 30,000 residents to have a Human Relations Commission, but they are not required to investigate complaints about discrimination themselves. Over the past few years, the state has been taking the local complaints. The council unanimously voted to send all investigation complaints to the state and have staff work to disband the local group's investigation and conciliation officers. Wednesday's Trib also had word that a Texas man was arrested after authorities said he drove a stolen car up to 110 miles an hour. Through Story County and into Ankeny while trying to evade arrest. Authorities said 42-year-old Joseph Raymond DeSalme drove through three red lights and nearly hit another vehicle in Ankeny, then jumped out while his vehicle was still rolling with a passenger inside. He was booked into the Story County jail. Also, Wednesday's Trib had word about an Iowa State University student who traveled the world this past summer for three internships. One of those internships took Chanel Vidal to Rhode Island, which isn't that far away, but her next one took her to India, which is, and her final one took her to the Canary Islands. Now she's back here in Ames starting her sophomore year at Iowa State, and you can read all about her adventures in Wednesday's Tribune. Thursday's Tribune reported that U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue will attend the Farm Progress Show in Boone next Wednesday. Perdue is scheduled to appear at the show's hospitality tent between noon and 1 on Wednesday afternoon. In addition, lieutenant governors from 8 states are scheduled to gather in that same tent from noon to 1 on Tuesday to talk about agricultural policy. The Farm Progress Show is an annual event for seed developers, machinery firms, and other ag companies to show off their latest products to farmers and investors from around the U.S. and from around the world. It will run Monday through Friday next week at the Central Iowa Expo, just north of U.S. Highway 30 between Ames and Boone. Thursday's paper also had word that Ballard Elementary School students were welcomed back to classes this week, and they got their first chance to play on new playgrounds at the West and East Ballard Elementary Schools. The new playground structures replaced 25-year-old structures that had become potential safety hazards for the kids. Thursday's paper also reported that a new gym being run by former Iowa State football players has opened on the west side of Ames. Premier Athlete Training focuses on developing so-called functional fitness that athletes can use during their chosen sport. The Trib also reported that the Story City Friends Endowment has reached a new mission, a new milestone. It awarded $2,500, the most it's ever given out, to 5 local nonprofits. Those nonprofits are the Story City Fire Department, the Boy Scouts Troop 101, Judge Story's Theatrical Troop, the Story City I-35 Memorial Boulder Roof Project, and the Story City Historical Society. And Thursday's paper had previews of 2 events. One, the First Friday in Campus Town gathering here at Ames, which is designed to welcome new and returning students to Iowa State. Anyone from the community is welcome to attend, and it starts this afternoon at 4. And there was word about the Prairie Fest in Huxley, which begins at 10 tomorrow morning with a parade. It's the 24th year for this annual celebration, and it will have a little something for everyone, including food, entertainment, and competitive events. Today's Tribune reports on its website, not in its print edition, that one person is in custody after Iowa State University police and Ames police responded to reports of armed suspects near campus late last night. After a couple of hours of searching, authorities said one person was taken into custody and that the weapons were airsoft guns. In today's print edition of the Trib, Word that District Court Judge Timothy Finn has died at the age of 69. Finn recited over cases in Story, Boone, Marshall, Hamilton, and Hardin counties. He was appointed to the bench back in 1987 after having practiced law in Ames. Today's Trib also reports that an Ankeny man has been charged in a Story County revenge porn case. 23-year-old William Joseph Badger is accused of sending a photo and a video of himself having relations with a woman to that woman's parents. And today's Trib reports that climate activists have announced a march from Des Moines to Fort Dodge next month to protest the Dakota Access Pipeline. The week-long march will begin September 1st outside the Iowa Utilities Board office and will pass through Ankeny, Huxley, Ames, and Boone, ending September 8th at Fort Dodge. The marchers will try to rally support for a lawsuit which alleges that the Utilities Board improperly exercised eminent domain on some landowners so that the pipeline's parent company could get access to their property. And that is your summary of the week's news from the pages of the Ames Tribune. I'll be back here on Monday with a look at news from around the state of Iowa, and there was a lot of news around the state of Iowa this week. A reminder, this is Local Talk on KHOI FM 89.1. I'm Dennis Hart. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources is making a general call for Iowans in our area to help them with a two-year program they are conducting. What they're looking for is a particular type of native bumblebee that is on the endangered species list. They're hoping to discover the bee in more counties around the state, and they're asking you to help by being on the lookout. Ursula Rudenberg sat down with DNR environmental specialist Seth Moore to talk about all of this.
Hello, my name is Seth Moore. I'm with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. I'm an environmental specialist in the Land and Waters Bureau. And today we're just going to talk a little bit about Iowa's endangered bumblebee. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has recently listed the rusty patch bumblebee, scientific name Bombus affinis, on the endangered species list. This bumblebee was once widespread in about 31 states. It's only found in 9 states right now. The decline started around 1990s. And just want to get a grip of where they're at and help the populations boost back up.
This is a way that you, the listener, can get involved.
Exactly. You,
the DNR is hoping that citizens will see this bee and let you know?
Yeah. This is kind of a citizen science project. We're asking people to get out there and in your yards, your fields, your pastures, wherever you have blooming flowers. If you can find it, let us know. We are trying to get a hold on where it's at, the distribution of that bee in our state.
Is this bumblebee the kind of bumblebee we're used to thinking of, the big bee that kind of buzzes?
It is. This one is special as it has a rusty patch on the back. And so on the back, there's yellow and then a rusty patch line and then another yellow line basically underneath that. That's kind of the distinguishing markers of that species.
And it's big.
It is. It's a larger bee.
And it kind of hums?
Yes. You'll hear that when it's flying past you or in your flowers.
Most bumblebees are relatively docile.
Is this
a docile bee?
It is. Most of the time, bees are just trying to get their groceries. They're foraging on flowers, looking for nectar and pollen for their nests.
Rusty patch bumblebee. Bombus affinis?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They're native to Iowa.
Yes, they are. Uh-huh. Originally, they were kind of a common bee, really, but now in Iowa, they're restricted to certain counties. So Blackhawk, Clayton, Johnson, Allamakee, Jackson, and Winnesheek are their main counties that we've found them recently. Now, just this year, since we are actually doing surveys to look for them this year and next year, we've actually found 2 in Boone County and in Linn County.
Not in Story County yet.
I'm looking right now, but I haven't found any yet.
You're on the lookout to find out if they're in other counties as well?
Yes, we are. This time of year is a pretty good time, and I encourage people in your yards, if you've got any kind of flowers at all, look to see if you can find it. On our Facebook page, and we've had some press releases about what the bee kind of looks like, but you can also contact me, and you can send me any pictures you have, and we can take a look and see what you have. Another great way is bumblebeewatch.org. That's a website. You can create a free account. You can upload any pictures of bumblebees, and there's experts on that website that will identify them for you. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service tracks that website, so if a rusty patch does come up, they can grab it and catch it. And
you'll find out about it?
Yep, and we'll find out about it as well, since we're working together on that kind of a joint project.
Why are they disappearing, and why are they coming back?
That's a great question. We think there's a lot of contributing factors, so loss of habitat. There's a lot more row crops, so that's not providing as much flowering resources for those bees. Not a lot of undisturbed ground for them to nest in. And we still have that in the road ditches and things like that that they can use. But pesticide use, a lot of widespread pesticide use. And then disease and parasites can be a problem. The common eastern bumblebee has been used to pollinate tomatoes. And that bee has actually become more widespread across the country because so many people use them to pollinate, and they kind of escape the greenhouse. And sometimes they can be disease carriers, and they can get out and transfer different diseases and parasites to the bee. And we think that might be a contributing factor as well.
Why is this important?
Well, as the Iowa DNR, we're always wanting to make sure we're managing the natural resources of the state wisely and being a good steward of what we have. And the pollinators in general, and then bumblebees specifically, are a great contributor. The services they provide for pollination, for crops, for native plants is tremendous. Bees are really kind of the workhorse of the pollinator world. The only other insect that really can compare with them would be flies, and flies don't do it in a way that bees do. Bees will go to the same flowers a lot, so that provides that pollination service for those flowers. Flies just kind of go wherever they want, but they have hairy bodies like bees. Bumblebees in particular have a lot of hair on their bodies. They can collect a lot of pollen, and they can forage earlier in the day and later in the day than a lot of pollinators do. Most pollinators like butterflies or beetles or flies have a restricted time frame during the day which they're visiting those plants. But bees will do it almost all day long. Even when it's kind of chillier and other insects can't fly because of the temperature, bumblebees are active during those times. They can warm their bodies and they can contract their muscles in their body and generate heat, which allows them to fly.
So they're important.
They are, yep, mm-hmm. Very important for crops, native plants. They do the lion's share of the pollinating. So making sure that we have them, have enough of them, and are keeping the ones we have here. And then, you know, it's an interest of me mm-hmm. personally, too, working with specifically bees.
Why do you like bees?
I've always looked for things that maybe don't get a lot of attention, and that's just one that kind of caught my eye, and I've just been drawn to it. So I'm looking forward to learning more about them and don't know nearly enough.
So. Now, bumblebees don't make honey.
Right, that's right. Honeybees are the only ones that make honey. Bumblebees collect nectar for their young and pollen. Nectar is mostly going to contain the energy, so carbohydrates and sometimes amino acids, and then the pollen is more of the protein. That's why they want those things. Bumblebees are different than honeybees. Honeybees have a colony year-round, usually have 10,000 plus bees in that hive or colony. A bumblebee basically will have 500 to 1,000 individuals, and then at the end of the year when new queens are raised, everything else dies except queens over winter, and then those queens in the spring, when they wake up and look for nest sites, which is usually an underground rodent burrow or mammal burrow, that's what they look for.
So they want to live in the ground.
Right. Their nest is in the ground. They don't nest above ground majority of the time. So they're kind of out of the way. It's hard to find their nests. If you see them, they're usually going to be on flowers looking for nectar and pollen to provide for their young in their colony.
The queen, or how does she reproduce if she's alone?
In the fall, whenever the colony produces new queens, they also produce males or drones. And then those drones and the new queens mate, and then the females will overwinter, and then in the spring they'll start to make their nests, and then they start to lay eggs. They don't lay eggs until in the spring.
So the queen gets essentially fertilized in fall?
Yep, that's right.
And then she goes and she goes to sleep,
mm-hmm.
and then she finds a nest somewhere in the ground, and then she lays a bunch of eggs.
Yep, exactly. And then she raises those eggs. She's the sole provider for those eggs until they mature and become workers.
And how does she provide for them?
So she's looking for, you know, plants that are offering pollen and nectar. Some of the best plants you can use are native plants. So native plants would be anything that was here in the continental U.S., before European settlement. Wild bergamot is a really good one. They love that. It's actually called bee balm, another common name for it. Another one would be white wild indigo, culver's root, butterfly milkweed. A lot of the milkweeds, great for bees.
What about coneflower or black-eyed Susan? Or
yes, those will work as well.
But those don't bloom in spring, right?
Right, exactly.
So she needs spring flowers.
Yep, if you can get as many spring flowers. That's hard to find sometimes with native plants, with suppliers, seed, or finding live plugs. But we do have less. So wild geranium, Virginia waterleaf, anemones, wood betony. There's several there for the spring. They will use non-native species, those like clovers and things like that, too. They're just going to try to find anything they can to eat in the spring because it is kind of bare in the spring. A lot of times they'll go to the woodlands. Woodlands have a lot of wildflowers in the spring when there's nothing else in the open fields.
One more question about the reproductive cycle. Mm-hmm. When she lays her eggs, the babies, are they all male?
In the spring and until probably mid-summer, they're all female. And then once we get into the late summer, early fall, she'll start producing males and then eventually the queens, the new queens.
Oh, so it's three different types of babies she has.
Yes, yep.
What do the females do?
The females that are produced the majority of the year, those are the workers. They do all the work collecting pollen and nectar for the new males, queens, or workers.
To feed the other babies.
Right, exactly. Yep, they all work together. And the queens mostly, once she has enough workers raised, she stays in the nest for the most part.
What's she doing down there?
She's mostly just laying eggs.
And then later in the summer, the males are born.
Yes, yep, the males are born.
And what's their job?
They are just there for reproductive purposes mostly. They leave the nest and then they never really come back. They'll set up kind of a territory for themselves and defend their territory, and they'll look for new queens to mate with. And then at the end of the year, they die. Queen from the spring, she dies at the end of the year.
Okay, thank you. Well, every spring a colony of bumblebees would come and make holes in the wood fence behind our house.
Those are actually probably carpenter bees, carpenter bees aren't a bumblebee, but they look almost exactly like a bumblebee.
Okay.
How you can tell the difference is they bore in wood,
yeah,
like that, make their nest into wood, and their abdomen is very shiny, and it's not as hairy. Other parts of their body are hairy, except for that. It's very black and shiny. And the ones that get in front of your face are males or drones. They're kind of protecting their territory. And males cannot sting, so you don't really need to be afraid of them.
It comes off very cute.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, they're an interesting bee, for sure. Yeah.
Okay, so let's go back to your bee, Rusty Patch Bumblebee.
Yes.
What can I do to see a bumblebee?
Any space you have, you plant seeds or live plugs of native plants. You want something blooming all year round from spring until fall. And that's providing them those resources they need for their young and to reproduce and to thrive and survive. Another thing, provide a safe place for them to build their nests. This could be an area of your yard that's unmowed or just a place where there's no ground disturbance at all. They're kind of a generalist. They'll go wherever they can hibernate. I say that lightly because it's an insect. Just letting a little patch of your yard grow up, flower beds or compost piles, things like that. Those are great places for them to nest. They like sandy soil, loose soil, too, for their overwintering spots. They can burrow into the ground a little bit and just overwinter there. Compost piles are really good for that. Having that loose soil for them to go into, and sometimes they do overwinter in woodlands under the leaves. And then another thing you can provide is just a pesticide-free area for them. Careful application of pesticides, especially insecticides, which are particularly harmful to those bees. Read your labels on your pesticides that you apply and make sure you follow all the label instructions. And if you can do pesticide-free as much as possible, that's great. You want flowers from spring until fall. Plant, maintain those flowers. Safe place for them to build their nest. Undisturbed ground, compost piles. Then if you can make your property as pesticide-free as possible.
And then going out to look for them, you're just basically keeping an eye on the flowers?
Yeah, if you're interested in looking for them and taking pictures, going to any kind of public, county conservation board, Iowa DNR, state park, Army Corps of Engineers, whatever the case might be, any of those places that have wildflowers out there, that kind of a wild area, when there's not a lot of wind, it's bright and sunny, those are the best days to find them out foraging.
And they don't really care what time of day?
I would focus from 9 to 3. That's when you're going to see the most activity.
And how do you know that it's a rusty patch bumblebee? How are you going to recognize it?
Sure, yep. So a bee has a head, a thorax, and an abdomen from top to bottom. And the abdomen is the last segment. That's where the stinger would be. So on the abdomen, the back of the bee, you're going to look for the yellow rusty patch or that brownish color, and then another yellow band below that.
On the back of the bee.
So
you don't have to like turn it over to look at it.
Nope, you should be able to see it from just looking at the flowers. If you have some binoculars or if you just take some pictures real fast, and then you can look at the pictures.
Say again what the colors are.
So it's yellow, rusty, yellow.
Yellow, brown, yellow.
Yep, yellow, brown, yellow. There are some bees that have a yellow and then a brown. Those are brown-belted bumblebees. Very common bee. So just look for that yellow below the brown, and that's usually what's going to tell you it's a rusty patch bumblebee.
And it's a big one.
Yep, it's a bigger bee. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell whether you're looking at a queen, a drone, or a male? Or what do you call it?
A male drone, yep. A female, there's workers' drones and then queens or genes. Okay. Before they lay eggs, they're called genes. But yep.
Genes. So mm-hmm. How do you know which one you're looking at?
It's a little bit hard to tell, but typically queens are a lot bigger than everything else. The workers are smaller. If you search on the web, you can find the pictures there to know the differences. Drones typically will not have a pollen-carrying basket corbicula on the back of their hind leg, but that's harder to see. But what I look for is big eyes. Males usually have a lot bigger eyes than females. They don't have a stinger, and they will sometimes have a yellow buffy hair on their head. They'll fly around a little bit more usually and defending their territories.
Probably not a good idea to put in a jar, though, right? They probably don't like that.
Right. I wouldn't recommend that unless you have a scientific collecting permit or some type of mm-hmm. permit from the Iowa DNR to do that.
Now, I have a garden, and I've noticed this bee comes out of the ground. Is there a chance that that would be it, or are there other types of bumblebees that come out of the ground?
Sure. It could be a bumblebee, or it could be another type of bee. There's many species. In Iowa, there's 5 to 10 species of bumblebee, but there's around 400 different species of bee in Iowa alone.
Other types of bees live in the ground as well.
Yep. Actually, most bees nest underground. About a third will nest in hollow stems, wood, things with hollow cavities. So, yeah, if you see something in a garden like that, send pictures in. We're happy to identify anything we can. We like to see people getting out and become curious of the resources of the state.
So if you see a big fat bee, it's not necessarily a bumblebee. It can
right.
be other type.
It can be. And a lot of times bumblebees are hairy. If it's not hairy, it's probably not a bumblebee.
So, okay, take a picture.
Yep.
And tell us again, what is the best way to contact you to tell us you've seen the rusty patch bumblebee?
You can send your picture, comments, questions to me, Seth Moore. My phone number is 515-725-8464, 515-725-8464, or by email at seth.moore, M-O-O-R-E, @dnr.iowa.gov, or you can go to bumblebeewatch.org and create an account there and upload your photos, and there'll be people watching that website for it.
Seth, you work in Des Moines.
I do.
But you live in Story County?
I do, yes.
So you're keeping your eye out in Story County for a bumblebee?
Yep.
Okay.
Sure am. Hopefully we'll find it soon.
Well, if you do, will you break it on K2I?
Well, yeah, I'm happy to do that.
Thank you, Seth. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate the opportunity to be on and just talk about rusty patch bumblebee and other bees in general. So thank you.
Thank you. You have been listening to The Flight of the Bumblebee by Rimsky-Korsakov. And before that, you heard Ursula Rudenberg speaking with environmental specialist Seth Moore from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources about the endangered rusty patch bumblebee and about bumblebees in general. This is Local Talk on KHOI, and thank you for listening. During the next half hour of Local Talk, the Ames Progressive Alliance will be talking about local and community composting with Jennifer Jordan with Iowa City's Resource Management Program, who's on the phone, and Tim Good with Iowa State University Research Farms and specifically with Iowa State's compost facility. Carolyn Myers is our host and interviewer with the Ames Progressive Alliance. And Carolyn, take it away.
Good morning. So as Betty mentioned, we're going to be talking about composting. What do we do with all our waste that we produce? Ann Kinzel is unable to able to join us today. She will be back for the September show. So that we have to look forward to. This morning, let's start with Jennifer in Iowa City. She's on the phone with us. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Great. So you are the Resource Management Superintendent for Iowa City, and I'm sure that has a lot of different responsibilities. But tell me more about the Iowa City Municipal Composting Program. I know that in Iowa City there's composting citywide, which is exciting. Tell me more. What is composted? How did it get started?
Sure. Well, we actually started composting at the Iowa City Landfill and Recycling Center, which is actually owned by the city of Iowa City but serves all of Johnson County.
Mm-hmm.
And we started composting back in the late 80s with yard waste, like most other landfills across the state did when yard waste was banned by a legislative act at the state level. So we've had a semblance of a program for quite a while now. In 2007, we started looking at food waste, though, and it was mostly pushed by a group of University of Iowa engineering students. And that conversation led to a pilot project in taking food waste from one of the dorms on campus, Hillcrest Dorm. So we had a local push to get that started. If we had a memorandum of understanding with the university, and if it went well, the plan was for the university to expand what they were doing for composting and for the city to expand our capabilities, to take more food waste. So that's how the program got started about 10 or 11 years ago. And since then, we have continued to take in more food waste. We've done a lot of outreach to commercial generators. And just then in the last couple of years, we worked on getting a curbside program going. We already had curbside collection for yard waste, and we were able to add food waste into that. So that's kind of the genesis of the food waste composting program in Iowa City.
Oh, that's great. So tell me, how do citizens participate in the composting? Where do they get started? What are some of the rules and regulations around what they can compost and how it has to be stored?
Sure. And that's some of the stuff that we're working through now. We just started rolling out curbside carts for organics just in the last 6 or 8 months. And there has been a huge demand for them. And you can probably hear the smile in my voice. It was actually kind of unanticipated how many people would really want to participate in this program. So we are scrambling right now to get additional funding for more carts, which is such an amazing problem to have. But the rules for the program, and people don't have to have our carts to participate, but it's easier. And they clean up really well and they look nice. And it's easier for our curbside staff, too, actually. So we're trying to get more folks' carts faster. But folks can use their own containers at the curb as long as they're within our guidelines of that meet essentially weight and size requirements, because the staff still has to lift those by hand into the trucks that are picking up the organics. So because we have a commercial compost facility and it's permitted as such through the DNR, and we're a little ways out in the country, we're on the west side of Iowa City by about 3 miles, we can actually take meat and dairy, which a lot of other commercial composting programs or municipal composting programs can't. So if you think about Cedar Rapids, for instance, their commercial composting facility is in the middle of downtown, so they don't want to add any additional odors or increase what we politely call vectors, rats and mice and other things that might be wanting to eat that food waste. They have those constraints, whereas out here on the west side of town, we don't have as many of those constraints, so we can add in meat and dairy.
Oh, that's great. So what are, when you started talking about the weight restrictions, what are the weight restrictions that currently you have for curbside pickup?
Sure. If the public provide their own containers, the size of the containers have to be between 20 and 35 gallons, and they're limited to 50 pounds because, again, curbside staff is lifting those by hand into the back
sure.
of the packer truck.
So is that 50 pounds per week, or is that 50 pounds per month?
Oh, just per container. People can set out as many containers as they want. But if they're setting out 50 pounds of food waste, I would encourage them to check out one of our other programs, which is food waste reduction in the first place. So in looking at the state's hierarchy for all waste, reduce is always the first thing we want to consider. So composting is awesome. Anaerobic digestion is awesome. And I'm sure we'll have a chance to talk more about some of those things. But the real thing for people to consider is reducing food waste at the source, because not only is it saving us having to pick it up or them having to set it out at the curb, but it's saving them money and the food that they're not then eating, and it's also saving the resources that went into making that food, the chemicals, the transportation, the water, all of that stuff upstream.
Oh, sure, definitely. We want to reduce waste at every level. That makes a lot of sense. So when the program was first started, I assume you had to try to get a lot of community support behind the program. How were you able to do that?
We did have a lot of community support, and we're really fortunate in Iowa City. We have a lot of local environmental groups because of both Kirkwood and the community college here and the University of Iowa. And we have a bunch of local nonprofit groups who are really involved in environmental initiatives and really push the city to do better all the time, which is amazing. And it's really useful when we're looking at doing something that we can go to city council and say, look, the 100 grannies are behind this. We're really trying to get this moving. Or, you know, University of Iowa Environmental Coalition is willing to work on this with us. We have partners to do this. So oftentimes we're not necessarily looking for partners. They're coming to us, which is, again, a really good opportunity for us to get some stuff done.
Oh, that's great. So how were you, along with the city and the community, trying to get them to get behind this, did you have any pushback or any struggles trying to get municipal support, like from the city government?
No, our current council is actually pretty progressive in items like this, and they were really supportive. 2 years ago, we took a whole host of waste minimization items to council, including a cardboard ban, a secured load policy for the landfill, organics at the curb. We moved to single-stream recycling. So we've had a couple of busy years, but the local government has been very supportive of that. And again, the landfill is owned by the city, so we have a really close connection with city government, obviously.
Well, that's great. Tell me more about the funding. Where do most of the funding for this program come from? Does it come from city, from the, you know, do the city provide most of the funding? Do individuals, families have to pay for the composting?
Yeah, great question. So it's a couple different things. So in the past, prior to January of this year, people who wanted to have containers at the curb were able to provide those like they are now, but they had to purchase an annual sticker to put on the container, and it was $25. So we had maybe 15% of the population participating in that, so we had a lot of funds coming in that way. It was not covering the cost of the program, however. So in January, we went to an across-the-board $2 charge per month for all of our curbside customers, just like we have for trash and recycling. So residents on their utility bill every month see a charge for solid waste, for recycling, and now for yard waste and food waste.
Wow. Okay. So that's not only is that very economical, but it's surprising that it's such a low cost for the city members for, you know, not just recycling and for solid waste, but also for the composting. That's really great. So what happens to the compost once you collect it? Are citizens allowed to be able to come get some to use for fertilizer in their yard? Does it just stay there and the city uses it for fertilizer in other ways? After you have the compost, what do you do with it?
Yeah, that's a great question. We make about around 2,000 tons of compost per year at the Iowa City Landfill's compost facility, and we sell out almost every year. And that goes to local landscapers. It goes to some small local farmers. But I would say a lot of it probably goes mostly back to residents. We charge $20 per ton, but folks can get smaller quantities for a prorated lower amount. So, we are actually sold out right now till mid-September.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yep. It's great. It's a really great product.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, well, I'm going to transition more from Iowa City to talk more locally about composting here at Iowa State. We have Tim Good, who is the farm manager for the research and demonstration farms at Iowa State University.
That's correct. Good morning.
Good morning. So, Tim, tell me more about the composting program at Iowa State University.
Sure. The program at Iowa State was developed in the late 2000s, 2006 or 2007. and it was in conjunction with the new Iowa State Dairy Farm that was constructed just south of Ames. We built the facility with the dairy farm in mind, and the dairy farm is a primary source of compostable waste at the compost facility.
Oh, great. Okay. So what all is composted at Iowa State besides the dairy waste?
Sure. We handle any organic waste from campus, and that will include dining hall waste, which is pre-production food preparation items, pineapple tops, orange rinds, anything that comes out of the kitchen, also scrapings from the plates in the dining centers. We handle yard waste from campus. We handle greenhouse waste. We handle wood shavings from livestock arenas. We handle some bedding from the vet med college. So really anything that's organic and a waste on Iowa State campus or some farms can come to the compost facility and be composted.
Okay.
And our total inputs are about 8,000 tons per year.
Oh, great. Okay. So tell me why Iowa State wanted to start the composting program. Was it just initially for dealing with the dairy waste, or was there other things that was the driving force behind it?
Sure. Well, there are multiple reasons, of course, but the dairy waste, handling it in a timely and efficient manner, was primary. Cows make milk and manure every day of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Often manure in the industry is applied to crop fields, but there are crops growing in the fields 9 months of the year. So having a place to handle and process that animal waste was important, and that's a primary factor. But also the green aspects. Campus and the university wanted a way to handle other organic waste in an environmentally friendly, green way.
Oh, that's great. Okay. So is there a difference between how the farm waste is handled versus the waste from the dining halls?
No, they're very similar, in
fact. Okay.
Most items that come to the compost facility come in large trucks. They're going to be in dump trucks. They're handled in a bulk manner. They come across a scale. Everything is weighed in and out of the compost facility, and then it's dumped in piles inside a building. And then we take those piles and mix them with corn stalks, and corn stalks is our bulking agent or our carbon source, and they're mixed in the appropriate ratios and then placed in large rows inside of buildings where they can be composted.
Great. Okay. Wow. So the corn stalks, I wouldn't have thought of that, but that's a great way to get that carbon in there.
Well, they're a natural resource. We have lots of corn stalks in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
They provide lots of structure. A corn stalk is very stiff and rigid, so that structure provides porosity and ways for air to move through the pile naturally.
Mm-hmm.
So it's twofold. It's carbon source and its structure in the pile.
Great. So when did they start doing the composting in the dining halls?
It was probably added about our third year of production, so around 2010 or 11.
Okay.
Roughly.
And was there a specific way that you were able to get support behind doing that?
Sure. The dining residence halls, dining facilities has always wanted to be more green. I believe the city of Ames was also interested in getting some of that stream out of the other waste streams. Those protein and other nitrogen sources aren't ideal in the city of Ames waste stream, so we could handle it well. And campus also, the university in general, has wanted to be more green and having the dining centers involved. And also I think there was a strong student initiative. The students also wanted a more green way to handle the waste from the dining centers.
That's great.
So all those reasons pushed.
Yeah, definitely. It's encouraging to hear that the students really wanted more of an ecological and a green initiative within the university as well.
Yes.
Because, you know, it always makes me feel good that they're thinking about that. So are there any struggles you face currently with the current composting at the university with, I mean, anything, transportation, et cetera?
You know, we've been composting in this manner for about 10 years, and we've kind of have it figured out the way we do it, so we don't have a lot of struggles.
Oh, great.
As in all of outdoor organizations, the weather's an issue.
Mm.
We compost year-round. The snow can be an issue. Snow can blow into our piles, and that can choke the oxygen. So when the oxygen flow is limited, then the microbes can't work as hard. It's all about keeping those microbes healthy and strong, and that's providing oxygen and the carbon nitrogen.
Mm-hmm.
So weather is an issue. We do compost under roofs, so we keep the rain out of our piles, and that helps us a lot. We do have wide open sides in our building, so we have lots of natural ventilation, but the rooftops help. Other struggles, I think the learning process initially was challenging,
mm-hmm.
figuring out how to handle such a large stream of material and keep it flowing through the system. It takes about 16 weeks to compost the material in our facility, so 4 months. So we turn over our buildings about 3 times a year.
Wow, that's quite a bit. What does Iowa State do with the composting once it's finished?
Sure. Our permit process mandates that all the material that we handle originates from Iowa State University and returns to Iowa State University.
Mm.
So the bulk of our compost goes back to campus. It is mixed with topsoil in about a 1-to-1 ratio, and then it's used around new building projects. It's used in lawn repairs. It's used in planting beds. It's used all over campus, and it's anytime you see exposed black soil on campus, it probably originated from the compost facility.
Okay. And if a resident of Ames wanted to participate in the Iowa State University composting program, could they do that?
Our permit does not allow us to do that.
Okay.
All material must originate and return to Iowa State facilities or land.
Sure. Okay, that makes some sense. Does Iowa State really save any money from the composting, you think?
I think so. When we think about the dairy manure, that composes of about 6,000 tons a year. And that's a lot of material that somebody would have to drive to the farm fields and apply. And so it's more efficient for the dairy.
Okay.
I want to thank you for this conversation. Just remind folks that you are listening. You're tuned into KHOI Community Radio 89.1. This is Local Talk, and this is the monthly Ames Progressive Alliance segment.
Thank you, Betty. Okay, so I have a couple questions for both of you, both Jennifer and for Tim, and you can chime in when you feel comfortable. But what do you think is the most important aspect of the composting? Is there anything I haven't asked you that you want to talk about with the compost initiatives?
Yeah, I'll go ahead.
Broad question. Go ahead, Tim.
Go ahead, Tim.
Sure. I think I'd just like to reiterate the fact that it's a really green way to handle the organic waste that are produced by Iowa State in various ways. And we're very satisfied with the product that we've produced, and it does a good job on campus.
That's great. Okay. Jennifer?
Thank you. I'll piggyback on that. I totally agree with Tim. It's a good way to handle the stuff that we don't have better ways to deal with or that we can't source reduce. So in our outreach, we really are encouraging folks to reduce at the household level and at the commercial and business level. So I'll point out that the Environmental Protection Agency has some really good programs out there for businesses and for households to be thinking about, you know, what you purchase, how you use what you've purchased. Simple things like shopping from your refrigerator and freezer, using up, especially this time of year, my tomatoes are going gangbusters right now. So making sure that we're getting those picked and, you know, frozen or preserved in some other way so that we're not wasting that food. But really looking at the source reduction is something that we've tried to push in Iowa City.
Wonderful. Well, I'd like to thank both of you for coming this morning, Jennifer Jordan and Tim Good this morning. That was great, a great conversation about composting. Please be sure to keep up with Ames Progressive Alliance activities on our website and Facebook. You can also find us on Twitter. And you can also find copies of this radio show on KHOI's website as well as the APA Facebook page. As always, thank you to KHOI for hosting this show. We love that you're doing so much more to help the community towards a more progressive future. Thank you.
And Carolyn, this is Betty. I would like to jump in. We do have a few more minutes left.
Oh, okay.
So I would like to jump in and ask Jennifer another question.
Sure.
Jennifer, I understand from Googling on the internet that you are a certified compost specialist. And I was curious about what that meant. And also, if you know if there are other cities in Iowa that have municipal or local composting programs like Iowa City does.
Sure. Well, I'm actually glad Tim mentioned earlier the kind of how their process started, because back in, I think it was 2012, we actually sent 4 or 5 of our staff people over to the Ames facility to do a 3-day training there for composting. And part of that was looking through the dairy and the composting area. So I have a little, this goes back a few years, but I do have a little knowledge or recollection of that facility. So we have several staff here at the Iowa City Landfill who are certified compost operators, and that's actually a condition of our composting permit through the Department of Natural Resources. So there are a small handful of landfills across the state of Iowa that do have commercial composting. Technically, it's called solid waste composting permits. And so there are a handful of operators across the state. And this goes back to a question earlier from Carolyn. One of the issues that we've had is we are having a hard time finding local training for our operators. So we've been able to do some online, but that would be, I guess, one of the challenges that we've faced here locally is keeping getting people trained as far as new staff, and then keeping our CEUs, our credit hours, up. So, that was tying back to the Iowa State. That's kind of interesting, I think, that that they were able to do the training at that point. I don't know if that's still the case. Tim, do you know if training is still going on at Iowa State? Because we haven't been able to find anything.
Sure. Iowa State has offered training through their Ag Engineering Extension group. And I don't think they've had a training session in a few years, but it may be something they'd look at and do again.
That would be great. We would love to participate.
And Jennifer, one more question. Since dairy cow manure is, I assume, not a big part of the Iowa City program, and you have, I think you said, about 2,000 tons that are coming in, is it all organic food types and yard waste, or is there something else that makes up part of what you compost?
Yeah, so we actually have about 2,000 tons going out every year.
Oh.
And similar to Iowa State, we take in about 8,000, 8,500 tons a year. And that includes food waste, which is roughly about 1,000, somewhere around 700 to 1,000 tons per year. And then the remainder of that is leaves that we do a vacuum program in the fall in Iowa City, wood waste, and then regular yard waste that we pick up throughout the year. So it's the organics portion of that, the food waste organics portion is, you know, not even quite a quarter probably.
Okay. If we don't have any more questions on this end, I want folks to know that you've been listening to Local Talk. Carolyn Myers with Ames Progressive Alliance and myself, Betty Baird, have been your hosts for the past half hour. Earlier in the show, we also heard a roundup of local news from Dennis Hart and information about the Rusty Patch Bumblebee from Seth Moore, Environmental Specialist with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Thank you again for listening. Local Talk airs today at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also, please remember that you can hear a recording of this show later today online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. Also, remember that KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm. Thank you to both of you, Tim, and thank you, Jen, on the phone. And goodbye. Hope to talk to you later. I would like to add that our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard Rimsky-Korsakov's Flight of the Bumblebee. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join the Local Talk team. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.